You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, games are supposed to be fun, but more and more we're seeing aspects of games used in some of the less fun parts of our lives, like work or school or exercise, our finances. And unlike games that are fun, if you lose at these kinds of games, you can face real-world consequences, and you can't just insert another quarter to try again. The idea of gamification has been on the rise since the early 2000s, and our next guest thinks it has positive uses, but it often goes too far. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see examples of gamification in your life? Do you use some kind of app, a language, or exercise, or something like that gives you points or reward streaks or sets you up against other people? How about your workplace? Or have you seen this in a school? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you've encountered this, tell us what you think about it, if it motivates you. Adrian Hahn is the founder and CEO of the game development company Six to Start, creators of the popular mobile fitness app Zombies Run. He's the author of the new book, You've Been Played, How Corporations, Governments, and Schools Use Games to Control Us All. Adrian, thanks for joining us today.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Can you start off with sort of a working definition of gamification? What does it mean?
Yeah, it's basically the use of ideas from game design, like points, badges, leaderboards, missions, that sort of thing, for non-game purposes. So for things like education, health, fitness, anything that isn't just about entertainment.
A lot of your book and a lot of our conversation are going to be about the misuse and abuse of gamification. But you don't think it's necessarily bad in and of itself. You use it, for example, in apps you've created. At best, what can gamification help us do?
Well, I think that gamification can help us achieve things that we know we should be doing or we really want to do, like learn a language or, you know, get fit or just learn new concepts. But we find it kind of difficult to do so or really tough. So I think one really fun game out there is called Kerbal Space Program. And it's all about learning physics and orbital mechanics by launching little creatures into space. And it's very accurate. And it's just a great way of learning science. But also, I think there's all sorts of fitness games. You know, a lot of people play Nintendo's Ring Fit Adventure. I used to play Dance Dance Revolution, you know, when I was a kid. And, you know, a lot of ways to make boring activities a bit more fun.
Now, let's stay with those self-improvement apps. I find, you know, I've got a fitness tracker. It gets me out going for walks. I do a language one. It keeps me motivated to keep my streak going to learn a language. That's great. But you say sometimes gamification is misused in those self-improvement apps for a variety of reasons. Where do we start to go wrong with those?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned streaks, because I think that's a really powerful motivator for a lot of players. So, you know, a lot of people use Peloton, a lot of people have Apple Watches, and a lot of these are fitness apps and games use streaks to encourage people to work out, you know, 5 days in a row, 10 days in a row, 100 days in a row. You know, you see people showing off their streaks and trying to maintain them even at the expense of their own health. You know, we know that it's not healthy to be exercising when you're ill. Even if you're not ill, it's just good to have rest days when you're running or swimming or cycling. And these streaks, you know, if they're designed in a really simple way, which is how most of them are, if they give people achievements for just working out forever and not taking any rest, they can actually harm you. And that's one example of gamification that is against people's interests.
Talking to Adrian Hahn, his new book is called You've Been Played, How Corporations, Governments, and Schools Use Games to Control Us All. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you use one of these motivational apps that uses leaderboards or streaks, say, or points to reward you and motivate you? Did you? Did you stop? If so, why? And how about at your workplace? Are there competitions, productivity challenges, things like that? What do you think about those? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your experiences or your questions for our guest. Adrian, let's go to work now. You spend a lot of time looking at how companies are gamifying for better and mostly for worse. First of all, what kind of things are out there if people haven't encountered this at work?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's all over the place. I was amazed and kind of disturbed by how frequent it is. So a lot of people work in call centers now or in customer support, and their interactions with customers are timed down to the second. And if they are not, acting well, or if they're not, being polite enough or just responding quickly enough, then they can have points deducted. And they can slip down a leaderboard and not receive achievements. And if they do too badly in this kind of gamified system, then of course they can get punished and get fired. But I think one place which people will be pretty familiar with, one app, is Uber. And a lot of Uber drivers are having their compensation effectively gamified. So periodically, Uber drivers will be invited to choose from different quests. And in these quests, they can sign up to drive 30, 70, 100 trips in a week. And if they achieve the quest, then they get more money. And if they don't, then they lose that. And of course, you could say, well, isn't that a good thing? People like having more money. But if you talk to Uber drivers, which I've done and a lot of people have done, they find it kind of manipulative, because at the end of the day, it's all down to money. And I think they'd rather have more certainty rather than having to hope that they'll be offered these quests and hope that they can really achieve those goals. I think what they'd rather have is just better pay in general. And it's really interesting that they choose to call these things quests, rather than just tasks. And I think part of that is down to the fact that we're all used to thinking that quests and challenges and achievements are good things because we play video games. Everyone plays video games now. And it's really interesting and kind of a bit disturbing to see workplaces take those ideas from video games and try and use them in a way that can exploit people, I think.
Well, and you talk about what ends up being incentivized in that Uber driver's case, and then this can come up with certain truck driver systems too. The incentive might be keep driving, even though you might feel too tired to keep driving. Ultimately, the incentives can lead us in potentially dangerous directions.
Well, exactly. I mean, I people from Uber are on record for saying that they want drivers to drive as much as possible. Obviously, they would say that they don't want people to drive dangerously. At the same time, it's not just quests that Uber uses to try and manipulate people. There's all sorts of things, that tricks in the apps, gamification they use to try and get people to move to different areas of the city or just to drive more. And, I think that these systems can work in incentivizing people through money or just through visuals to try and get them to do more than they wanted to.
Now, you also look at use of these apps in schools, and I'll get to one of those in a minute, but one of the most amazing quotes from your book is a New York Times article about a classroom game app called Class Dojo. A third grader quoting here, "I like it because you get rewarded for your good behavior, like a dog does when it gets a treat." I mean, that third grade kid, he says a lot there.
Yes, this was one of the most eye-opening things I discovered while researching the book. This comes from an app called Class Dojo, which is used in supposedly 95% of US schools, and it's in schools around the world. And it basically does two things. The first thing is pretty simple. It's like a private social network for teachers, students, and parents, and that's fine. But the second thing is basically, it's an app that gives teachers the ability to reward and deduct points from all the students in their class in real time. So they can go and say, oh, if this kid is acting up or being too noisy, minus 10 points. If they're being quiet, if they are doing teamwork, then plus 20 points. And those points can often be traded in for treats. And again, this is not a new thing. We've had points and we've had badges in schools before. But as that kid says, there is something about the kind of continuous nature and also about the way in which this app works just from an audio point of view, which is really interesting and really different. So In Class Dojo, when you get points deducted, you hear the sad sound from the phone, from the teacher's phone. If you get points awarded, you get this happy sound. And, you know, the kids obviously associate that, you know, with being trained like a dog. And now, of course, you could say, well, this is good if it keeps a classroom under control. But really, is this the way that we want kids to learn in school, to be motivated in school? And I think that's a big question. Some people might say, actually, that's fine as long as kids behave. But I'm sure that a lot of parents would think otherwise.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Peter is with us in Racine. Peter, what did you want to tell us about?
So I actually work as a software developer for a manufacturing company, and we use scoreboards like this, the gamification, to motivate workers and to try and, you know, have them work off of each other. It isn't used to alter their pay or anything like that. It's just used to evaluate and address issues where performance does fall or where performance is exceptional. It's one of those things where, in my opinion at least, it's all about the ethics of how it's implemented. You don't want to do exactly what Uber's doing and encourage bad behavior or discourage good behavior because of the way your algorithms report on performance. But it can be used very constructively, at least in my experience.
And Peter, can I ask, how long has this been in place at your workplace?
Some of the scoreboards have been in place for 8 to 10 years now, and some of them we are implementing. It just, you know, every time we find a place where we can utilize it, it's great, but you have to be able to compare people on very even terms, and when you have different roles that don't mesh with each other, it's very hard to compare them.
Interesting. Peter, thanks so much for sharing that with us. Adrian, what do you think of Peter's example?
Well, I think it's really interesting because we've always had examples of giving feedback to workers in workplaces. And I think that makes a lot of sense. You know, people want to know when they're doing well and when they're doing poorly. And it can be nice having that feedback in real time. I think it really depends on scale. You know, it's hard for me to know whether one case or another case is done well. Certainly in some big organizations, one of the problems that we have with these gamified workplaces is that the only way you get feedback is through this computerized system, this gamified system, and there is no way really to talk to a manager. And it is being done in such a kind of fine-grained surveillance way that even if you slip up once, then that's it. And so that's obviously, I think most people would agree, that's just too cruel. Now, I think there are ways to do this in a way that isn't that doesn't punish people so much. But it really comes down to those rewards and punishments. You know, if the punishment for slipping up a couple of times is you're fired or you're docked pay, then, you know, that's too much. But if it's just, hey, we're going to have a chat, then that's probably okay.
Thanks a lot for sharing that with us, Peter. We're talking to game designer Adrian Hahn about his new book on gamification. It's called You've Been Played, How Corporations, Governments, and Schools Use Games to Control Us All. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you, like Peter, have something like this going on at your workplace? What do you think about it? How about in your school or your child's school? Have you used Class Dojo or some other behavior reward app like that? What do you think about that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Adrian Hahn, founder and CEO of the game development company Six to Start. His new book is called You've Been Played, How Corporations, Governments, and Schools Use Games to Control Us All. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions or to share your encounters with streaks or points or leaderboards at your work, your school, your exercise app, you name it, 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Kevin is on the line in Janesville. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, good afternoon. I'm a teacher. I have used these points-based systems with students on multiple occasions. Honestly, I do not like them. I think they are teaching kids the wrong idea of doing things for points or for not losing points. And until they internalize that this positive effort leads to positive consequence, they're a very poor crutch. Thank you.
Kevin, thanks for sharing that. Adrian, that gets to the heart of a big question here for students and others. What is our motivation? What should our motivation be for doing something like behaving and learning in school?
Well, exactly. I mean, I think, you know, he's drawing a distinction between extrinsic and intrinsic motivation, you know, where extrinsic motivation would be just trying to get someone to do something by effectively, you know, bribing or rewarding them with sweets or points or trinkets. And, you know, intrinsic motivation, you know, is where we want kids to learn English or learn science because they find it interesting or they find it, you know, engaging or they find it, you know, beautiful. And of course, you know, it's not always the case that kids are going to pick up on that immediately. And it's difficult to do that if you've got, you know, a huge class and you don't have a lot of time to prepare. So I do sympathize, you know, with teachers who do, you know, end up using ClassDojo. I think a lot of them probably would prefer not to. And I think it's a weird situation where I think some kids and some parents actually expect ClassDojo to be used in some places. But, you know, the problem is if you rely on it too much, then the only thing that the kids are trying to do is maximize points. And, you know, that only works for so long.
Thanks for the call, Kevin. Wendy joins us now in New Berlin. Wendy, hi.
Hello, Kevin. You just summed up exactly how I feel. I'm a retired teacher, and I got my degree in the 70s, and I think that makes a difference. So I found so many teachers doing these money programs or tokens, and I didn't do it. In fact, I fought against it by doing things like I would bring in a whole tray of chocolate chip cookies. And my students would be like, whoa, what do we do? You know, and I'd say nothing. I just like you. And that was for them to get. It's really, I think it's really seriously a problem. It's scary to me how children are being manipulated. And it is much easier for the teacher, but good luck trying to break that system.
Wendy, thanks for the call. Well, for somebody like Wendy at a school, making decisions at a workplace, you name it, how do you break out of that gamification, negative gamification mentality, Adrian?
I think it's tricky because obviously, you know, if you're just one teacher in a school and you've got, you know, a lot of obligations, it's hard to sort of swim against the tide. Especially, of course, if you're a worker in, you know, Amazon, or if you're a driver at Uber, you know, maybe you don't have a lot of power there. You know, I think as individuals, then, you know, we can try and push back against gamification when we encounter it in our own lives and just be aware of when we're being gamified. I mean, to take, for example, I've got an Apple Watch, and every month it tells me to try and beat my previous month's calorie goal. which is, as you can imagine, it gets increasingly difficult to do that to a point where it's impossible. And it's okay to just turn that off, right? You know, if you see that in your life, if you have an app like Duolingo or you have a watch that says, hey, please try and do more, you can just turn that off because that's not something that you're asking for. I think in schools, yeah, you know, I think I love that note by Wendy talking about just, hey, I'm just giving you these cookies because I like you, rather than, you know, it's a reward or a punishment. And, you know, that's something I try to do in my own workplace, you know, with my employees. I think people like getting positive feedback and they like getting, you know, learning about ways to improve. At the same time, I don't want to be in a situation where I'm just doling out points and badges every, you know, few minutes or every hour, as actually happens in some workplaces now. So, you know, if you're in a position of influence, then you can try and change things. If you're just someone who, if you're someone who works at a workplace, then you can ask them to change. But in your own life, I think there are places you can turn off gamification if you can.
Wendy, thanks for that call. I also accept chocolate chip cookies, if you like the show. Adrian, you're pitching messages to different audiences here. I want to focus on one, people who design apps and programs and workplace reward systems, what kind of ethical considerations do you want those people to have in mind as they design and then implement these kind of gamified setups?
Well, you know, I have a few different sort of like guidelines for how people can do it well. One guideline that I've mentioned before is really try and keep the rewards and punishments small, right? It's just not, it's not a good system if the punishment is you're fired or you're fined $10,000. It just makes people terrified, to be honest. It's not really a good motivator. And similarly, if you have a prize of $1 million, you know, $10,000 or free college or that sort of thing as the result of performing well in a gamified system, but people are just going to manipulate that. They're going to burn themselves out. They're going to cheat. It's not a way to motivate desirable behavior. I think another thing to do when designing these systems is ultimately to try and keep the customer or the players or the users' best interests at heart. And that is very hard to do. And sometimes, you know, people might say that's paternalist. But, you know, that's something that we just try to do in our own games. We try to think, look, how can we design this in a way that people are not going to be unhappy at us for making them overexercise or unhappy at us at spending more money than they wanted to? And sometimes that can go against the profit motive. And that's just something you're going to have to decide. And not every designer can make that decision, but you can voice your opposition.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Adrian Hahn. His new book is called You've Been Played: How Corporations, Governments, and Schools Use Games to Control Us All. Tomorrow on Central Time, we'll look at Hallmark and Lifetime holiday movies. Love them or hate them, we'll talk about them tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up, a parenting writer says American moms are held to unsustainable standards. We'll hear about her new book, Screaming on the Inside. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the immigration and health policy known as Title 42 was set to expire tomorrow, but Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts put that on hold for now. We'll talk with an immigration law expert about what's happening and what's at stake. Now, the pandemic changed a lot of things about parenting. School closures meant many had to juggle work and remote schooling. For a time, a lot of parents lost the help they got from support networks, including grandparents or babysitters. For a lot of parents, those expectations felt unrealistic. Our next guest says that's particularly true for mothers. And in a new book, she says that what's expected of American moms was already unsustainable long before COVID-19. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a mom yourself, do you struggle with feeling like you have to live up to unreasonable standards? What are those standards? Where do you think they come from? For anyone, how can we better support the mothers in our personal lives and in our work lives? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Jessica Gross writes a newsletter on parenting for the New York Times opinion section. Her new book is called Screaming on the Inside: The Unsustainability of American Motherhood. Jessica, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You write that in the U.S., mothers in a lot of ways are on their own. And this, in a lot of ways, started for you with your experience during your first pregnancy. Can you tell us about how reality quickly steered away from some of the ideals we might see?
Sure. So I was very sick during my pregnancy with my older daughter. I had just taken a new job. I found out I was pregnant on my second day of work. And then I proceeded to get extremely sick with hyperemesis, which is extreme morning sickness. And I was so sick, I could not stay in that job. And there were very few legal protections around me, which is unusual. In other peer nations that are as wealthy as the United States, parents have a lot more structures around them, including nationalized health care, including paid leave. So I had none of those things because I live in the United States. And while I knew about the limitations of public policy for parents and had reported on some of them before I got pregnant myself, actually living through it really brought it home to me in a very real way and kind of set me off on a path to think deeply about why we make it so much harder than in other wealthy nations to raise children and what might make it better. And I think what happened with the pandemic was many, many more people realized the many ways in which our country makes it difficult to raise children. I mean, one thing we don't even think about, but is so woven into our daily lives, is simply that the school day does not match the typical workday. So starting from there, every single day for parents who need to work to support their families is a puzzle piece of hours, you know?
Mm-hmm. Now, from your own experience, and you talk to other moms in the present day and read diaries from the last couple hundred years of American motherhood, it seems like in some ways the first rule of, you know, facing challenges as a mom is you don't talk publicly. You don't complain about the challenges you face as a mom. That's judged negatively. What kind of themes did you see when it came to even the ability to talk about these problems?
Well, so I absolutely adored reading these old diaries and letters because the emotions, especially around early motherhood, are eternal. So I remember most vividly a 19th century mom writing, I believe, in a letter to her sister that if she thought that she had to nurse a child for the rest of her life, she would, quote, lie down and die because she was so exhausted and she just couldn't imagine the stress and sleeplessness for ongoing forever. And they expressed the joys and the pains, but it certainly wasn't something that they would ever talk about publicly. This was all private communication, again, in diaries, in letters to only their closest intimate friends or sisters or mothers. And there's a lot of historical precedent for any time women would speak out about the difficulties they were experienced, they would get pushback. In some very disturbing cases in the mid-20th century, they were made to feel like there was something psychiatrically wrong with them. So in the sort of pronatalist push post-World War II, it was psychiatrically in vogue to tell women that if they didn't feel well during pregnancy or had doubts about their newborns, that they were neurotic and that they needed mental help. And they hated their own femininity. There was something wrong with them. So throughout history, there have been moments where just simply being honest about different kinds of feelings around motherhood have really been demonized.
You'd like to think that has changed, but you're a woman, a mom, writing about these challenges in the world where the internet exists. What have you encountered?
So it's really a range. I think today, more than ever, there is space and validation for a huge range of motherhood experiences. And I've heard from so many moms who really feel that they've been saved by internet groups where women have experienced what they've gone through. And then in other ways, there's just the nastiness and the trollishness that hits every other topic. But I think the difference with especially new parents is they just feel so vulnerable. So while you might be able to brush off a troll or more easily in other aspects of your life or other life choices you might make, I think especially that new parent moment, you're so vulnerable and exhausted. I think it's harder to deal with the various streams of information that are just coming at your face from every direction on the internet.
Talking to Jessica Gross, her new book is called Screaming on the Inside, The Unsustainability of American Motherhood. She says the image sometimes often doesn't match up with the reality. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you see if you're a mom or if you know one, what do you see as some of the unrecognized challenges of being a mom in this day and age? Or if you're looking back at your own life in your era of motherhood, join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, experiences, or questions for our guest or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You mentioned that idea of blame. And in the World War II era, you talk about moms being blamed for the way they parented kids who had problems later, sons after coming back from World War II and having trauma from World War II. that idea that you're going to be blamed for decisions you make, I don't think that's gone away. Can you talk about some of the things you encounter in the present day?
Well, so the example I use in the book is parents fretting over what is the first milk that they introduce to their toddlers. So I have just read so many internet threads where people are like, should it be whole milk? Should it be 1%? Should I even give my child dairy? Should it be plant milk? And there's this intense feeling that this choice is both extremely consequential and that also if something goes wrong with your children's health, it will be your fault. And I just think that that's underlying many, many decisions that we make along the way, again, especially when our kids are really little, because my kids are now 6 and 10, and they make a lot of decisions for themselves that I obviously have no control over. So I think a lot of that sort of concentrated anxiety around sort of every little thing mattering so much is really around those early years.
And it seems like across the political spectrum, someone might judge a mom for working while being a mom or not using organic milk while being a mom or fill in the blank with various parts. Can we dial down the judginess? Is that part of the problem here?
I mean, I would really hope so. I think part of the problem is when these interactions are happening online, we don't have the context of each other's lives, right? I mean, certainly I've witnessed and heard about interactions in real life where people are being judged, but mostly people, I like to believe that people will just mind their own business and live and let live. And I think when you have the context of someone and their real humanity, people are not quite so quick to judge when you're just seeing this one decision that someone perhaps made without any context about who they are, or who their children is, or what their family circumstances are.
That's other people judging moms. You write that you and many other moms struggle with judging themselves. They've seen, you know, these ideals of perfect moms out there. It seems like it'd be easier said than done to just ignore all that.
Oh, yeah. I am not suggesting that it is easy or that it's even possible to shut it all out. I think what I hope people take away from the book and from listening to us chat on the radio is anytime they feel that judgment or guilt or questioning themselves, they have to feel the feeling, but they can sit with it and say, what are my values? Are these somebody else's values? Do I even respect these values? Just sit and think about why am I feeling this way rather than having that guilt necessarily be a compass that guides them if it isn't even something that they really deeply care about.
We're talking to Jessica Gross, who writes about parenting for the New York Times. She's with us today to talk about her new book. It's called Screaming on the Inside, The Unsustainability of American Motherhood. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you, your own experience, maybe during pregnancy or raising kids? What did you see as some of the biggest challenges? Did you feel supported enough as a mom? What was missing if not? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with New York Times parenting writer Jessica Gross about her new book. It's called Screaming on the Inside, The Unsustainability of American Motherhood. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you are a mom yourself, if you're raising a kid right now or want to look back at your experience 10, 20, 30 years ago, you name it, love to hear what you saw as the biggest challenges, how you dealt with them, the places where the images and the expectations of moms didn't match up with the reality. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's bring on a caller now. Gwen is with us in Madison. Gwen, hi.
Hello. I just wanted to make a comment about the loss of the support system for young families. I'm 67 years old, and when I had my children, my mother was there to help me. She she and my father stayed for the first month with my oldest one. I was clueless as to how to take care of a baby. I was the youngest in the family and never saw a baby raised. And, you know, so many young families now are separated geographically from extended family, and they don't have that ability to say, Mom, could you come over? The baby's sick. I don't know what to do. Or, you know, an older sister or somebody. You know, people are unprepared and unsupported, and it makes it very difficult for young families nowadays.
Gwen, thanks a lot for sharing that. Jessica, what do you think?
I completely agree. Part of the reason that we live in New York, despite the very high cost of living here, is that my parents are here. And during the pandemic, we moved in with them for part of the time. I don't know what I would have done without them. My lives and my children's lives would be so much less rich and beautiful without my parents so frequently in them. And you saw during the pandemic, anecdotally, it's more anecdotal than I've seen solid data to suggest, but I know so many people who move near family because that moment made them realize I want to have this multi-generational life, and that's the kind of the best way to raise children in community. Because I think part of the problem we have now is that even two parents, it's just not enough to meet all of the needs.
Gwen, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Jessica, something else Gwen said along the way there was, like, starting off, she didn't know how to be a mom. And I think there's sometimes an assumption, expectation, maybe a self-expectation that this is natural. So you're naturally going to know what to do during pregnancy, during early child raising, and that isn't necessarily so.
Well, what I would always say to my husband when we were brand new parents, if he would turn to me and the baby would be crying and he would say, why is she crying? What does she want? I would say, I don't know. I don't speak baby. And so I offer that to you. I did not invent that phrase. I can't remember where I got it, but it is very useful because you are learning, and every baby is different, and part of sort of the excitement and fear is you're learning about your individual baby. And so no one is an expert. I mean, certainly each child, it does get easier, but every kid is so different. You shouldn't have the idea that you're going to be an expert when you start with it, because it's something that you can only really learn through doing. And certainly caregiving for other babies is a way to practice, but once it's all you, and it's 3 a.m. and there's nobody else around, you just kind of have to learn through experience.
Thanks a lot for the call, Gwen. We'll go now to Jeff in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Good afternoon and Merry Christmas.
To you too.
This is a great topic to address at this time of year. My mother was a single parent, so I know the struggles of what it was like to see my mom raise kids through many ages. She had her last baby when she was 44. And from the bottom of my heart, I honestly believe as a society, it takes a village. I would like to see mothers or newborn babies receive the support they need financially from, you know, national health insurance or from our government to provide that safety net and help that people need. I would support that legislation.
Jeff, thanks for that call. Jessica, in your conclusion, you talk about some policy solutions that might help.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think exactly what the caller is saying. I mean, national health insurance would go such a long way. I have friends who have given birth both in the United States and in European context, and it is night and day. They can't even believe the benefits of the systems around them, that, you know, nurses will visit your house when you're a new mother to make sure that you're getting along okay. There's nursing support. There's mothers groups that are, you know, supported by the government. I mean, there's just so much that we don't even know that we are missing out on that really helps mothers and fathers as well feel supported in those early days. I think, you know, paid leave, again, I don't think it's realistic to expect that the United States will ever be Sweden or Norway. It's always the Scandinavian countries that we talk about with the most generous benefits, but we do so little comparatively. Even 3 months of leave, which some states do provide, would be such a huge step in the right direction. And even as I was editing the book, two more states, I believe it was Delaware and Maryland, passed leave. So I do think we're going in the right direction. Childcare is another huge problem. There just is not enough to go around. I think there's a number of ways we could fix that. I think often the solution is just more paid childcare, but if we could support parents staying home for longer, there would be less of a need for childcare, especially in those early infant days. So I think that there's so much to be done in the American context and there's any number of ways to do it, which is both exciting and also demoralizing because there's such a long way to go.
Thanks for that call, Jeff. We're talking to Jessica Gross. Her new book is called Screaming on the Inside, The Unsustainability of American Motherhood. Back to your calls now. Elle is with us in East Troy. Elle, thanks for calling. What did you want to share with us?
I was just wondering if she had any input on pregnancy loss. I've been pregnant many times and have lost many. And I was wondering how to not be so bitter towards the doctors that wrote me off due to a pre-existing condition that many times, and also how to be happy for people who are around me that are pregnant.
Well, thanks for the call. Do you have any thoughts for Elle, Jessica?
Well, first, I just wanted to say that I'm so sorry for all your losses. It is gut-wrenching. It is so difficult, and that there is absolutely no sugarcoating how hard and painful it is. So I think that that's just one thing to keep in mind, that it's hard, it's painful. I had a loss in between my two daughters, and it is pretty awful to go through. So I really empathize. I think in terms of coming to a place where you can be happy for other people in your life, again, it is very challenging. I remember in my own life, I had a friend who was due around the same time as my loss, and I could not face her until after her baby was born. It just was too painful. So I think one thing to do is kind of identify for yourself what specific triggers of your pain are. So for me, it was, I just couldn't see this friend while she was pregnant. Once the baby was there, it was fine. I could, you know, get over it. I could enjoy her baby with her. I could be happy for her. But I think it's recognizing that you're, and accepting that you are going to have a mix of complicated emotions and that that's okay. If you can't bring yourself to be really happy for someone, that's really natural, because especially if you've gone through so many losses, that weighs on you. Again, I talked to many women for my book who really found solace in online communities where people had multiple losses, because they found that unless people in their lives had experienced the exact same thing, they couldn't they could be empathetic, but they couldn't identify. They couldn't really understand that deep pain. And so that might be another way to find community and support. And there's also, you know, in-person groups. Friends of mine are in-person groups that where they discuss multiple losses. So I really hope that you find some peace, because it is so difficult.
I hope that helps. And thanks for being willing to share that with us. Jessica, in just our last minute or so, can you share some advice for moms who feel like, gosh, I'm falling short on what I think being a mom should be? How can they work through that a little bit?
Well, I mean, every day, just try to be kind to yourself. That might sound cheesy, but just anytime you have a self-blaming thought, think, would I say this about my best friend? If you wouldn't say it about your best friend, don't say it about yourself. And every day, again, these are sort of small changes, because often we don't have the agency to change the big things. If we must work a certain number of hours to make ends meet, you know, there are limitations to those sort of changes to our lives that we can make. However, most days I find that there's one thing that is not imperative that I do. I just don't have to do it. I think I should do it, but it is not necessary. And so if there's one thing on your plate that you can just take off every single day, try to do that, because it will bring you at least a little more time for yourself, a little more peace.
Jessica, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Jessica Gross. She writes about parenting for the New York Times opinion section. With us today to talk about her new book, it's called Screaming on the Inside, The Unsustainability of American Motherhood. Coming up after the news, lots of asylum seekers are waiting at the U.S. border with Mexico. Could that force Congress's hand on reforming immigration policy? We'll look at that and the possible end of an enforcement policy known as Title 42 with an immigration law expert. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.